Thank you very much. That was very nice. Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here. I hope you can hear me because I don't have a very loud voice, and I do have a microphone. I assume we can turn it up if there's any problems. So raise your hand or something if you do. All right. So as Tamant said, the passion I have in my career that has developed is that I wanted to do something. I mean, I studied mathematics because I liked it, and then I decided it wasn't practical enough, and so then I switched over and wanted to do all these, you know, societal change issues, including things with the environment. And then it was my great delight, eventually, as computers became much more powerful, that we could actually use some of this mathematics that I'd learned on solving real environmental problems. So the area that I have an interest in is how do we use computers, computational mathematics, in an efficient way that helps us solve real environmental problems. And so I kind of work on both sides of the aisle. I have one project down in a nearby county where we're worried about manure from cattle. You know, I mean, it can't get much more earthy than manure. And then, you know, and then I also get to do a lot of things like give talks to mathematics groups. So it's a very exciting career to have. So I'll try to give you kind of an overview of it without going into all the details of everything that we're doing. So when we talk about this particular, this is the Cannonsville Reservoir in a county close to Ithaca. This is a beautiful picture and a beautiful place that you'd like to protect and keep its ecosystem going and so forth. But it also happens to be the water supply for New York City. The water from here gets shipped about 150 miles to New York City. It's one of five or six watersheds that they take water from. And the issue is that if phosphorus from the animal waste gets into this water, then it promotes the growth of algae and rooted plants, and that then messes up the New York City water supply because they have to then build a mechanism that filters the water, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but when you're talking about that many millions of people, the plant by itself would cost $8 billion, and the cost of maintaining it every year would be another $100 million or something. So it's a huge cost to keep this water clean, and so what we want to do is to try to do it, to look at it from the watershed level, not from just the water. So the reservoir is here, this sort of gray-greenish area, that's the reservoir you just saw a picture of. And then all this area up here is the watershed. And what happens is there's animals, mainly agriculture are the source. There's phosphorus deposited in the manure all over the land surface. The rain falls, and it moves the phosphorus through the land surface, down through the rivers, and into the reservoir. And so how do we deal with this? Well, if we're trying to manage this problem, what we want to know is what's going on in the reservoir, where is the phosphorus coming from, and how do we model it in such a way that we can have an accurate enough model to be able to look at management alternatives. So these different colors here are describing different combinations of either land use, like do you grow corn or do you grow alfalfa or lawn, you know, what is covering the land. That has a huge impact on how much phosphorus it's going to generate. And then also the soil type, which that can have to do with how the water moves and how much erosion that you get. So this is just to give you an example. And by the way, I want to just to get an idea of the scale, going from here to here takes a couple hours to drive. This is about a 1,200 kilometer squared watershed. So it's a very big area, and that's the kind of scale that we're modeling watersheds at. And of course, you get to climate problems, it's even larger. So we're interested in, we talk about models. They're trying to cover as well as you can, given the data that you have, sometimes large areas of a lot of uncertainty involved. So that's the kind of problems that environmentalists are facing. Now, where does mathematics come into that? Well, how does an environmental engineer or scientist, or for that matter, any other kind of engineer, construct and use a model? So these steps are not specific to environmental engineering. First, you have to have some data. You want to try to, you're trying to describe a real situation. So you get some, either you collect your own data, or what's more likely is there's places like USGS that have data stations that they keep their data. Then you pick up, you pick a model. Now, typically these models are so complicated, you don't just write your own model. You go to some pre-existing model, like the model that we use for that watershed is called SWOT. It's developed by USDA, and it's been used in thousands of places all over the world to help them manage their watershed and water quality management. And so you pick some pre-existing model, you have some data, and now the next thing you want to do is the model is going to have parameters, and these models are used all over the world. And so, and for example, the model was developed in Texas, the SWOT model, and we're using it where it's very dry and not very cold, and we're trying to use it in the Northeast where there's big snowpack, much colder temperatures. So you can imagine that you'd need to have different features in the model to deal with this range of things. And so that's how these models are built. That's why they have so many parameters, because they're trying to deal with all kinds of different situations. So you essentially have hundreds of parameters. And so the first step that we're trying to promote, we're trying to sort of develop a method for how you go about doing this in a systematic way, is to use some kind of a sensitivity analysis procedure to decide of these hundreds of parameters, which are the 20 or 30 maybe that you can really work with in a multivariate sort of way. So that's a first step, which I'm not going to talk about today except to say that that's one of the things we do. Now the second step is that once you've identified the multiple parameters in the model that you want to work with, let's say we have 20, for example. That means now I want to adjust those 20 parameters in order to get the model to fit the data. And I could adjust them manually, but it's more efficient to do an optimization with the parameters as decisions. So the decision variables are the parameter values. And so we use an optimization, and then what you're trying to do is to minimize the difference between the model predictions and the data. And that's what your optimization is what you're trying to do. And then another step is you take that calibrated model and then make sure it works okay on an independent data set. Then, now, next you're going to look at management schemes. Once you have this model that supposedly works well, you can look at management schemes like, well, one thing we could do is just turn all the manure into fertilizer and sell it at the local stores as bagged fertilizer. They do this. There's something called Milorganite that they do in Wisconsin. Of course, they have to treat it and process it and everything to make it sanitary. So that's one option. And that, you know, that's one thing that you could do. Not necessarily the most economical thing to do. We look at other methods like feed the animals differently, and that can have a big impact. So these is looking at different alternative management schemes. And then lastly, and one thing that I want to point out was uncertainty. So these are complicated models. The data's not perfect. The models aren't perfect. And your ability to estimate the parameters in the best way possible is also not perfect. So why do this? Well, the reason you do it is you have to make decisions. And you have to predict, in many cases, in environmental cases, you're trying to look far into the future. There's no other way to do it except to have a model. And the model is a systematic way of organizing the information you have in the best way possible. You use your understanding of the principles, the scientific principles, which in the case of watersheds are that water moves downhill, and as it moves downhill, it picks up soil particles, and those soil particles may have some phosphorus attached to them, and you know that's the nature of the kind of thing that you're trying to model. So this is the overall framework within which we do this, and I wanted to talk about it in terms of, say, the watershed and groundwater models I'm going to talk about here, but Ron is also going to talk to you about some climate issues later, and you could they do the same kind of thing here. They have the same problem here, and so the methods that I want to talk about from a mathematical point of view, since that's the group here, the things that are most interesting mathematically that we're doing are how do we do this optimization of the parameters, and given that these simulation models are complicated and hence computationally intensive, and also how do we assess the uncertainty? We want to use these models to make predictions. We know they're not going to be completely accurate, but you'd like to know, you know, is the range of uncertainty this big, or is the range of uncertainty so big that it's almost useless? So that's kind of the introduction. And so the outline of what I'm going to talk about then is, first I'm going to spend most of the time actually on optimization of multimodal functions. That means that there's more than one global, more than one local minimum. I'll talk about first an application so that you get a sense of how we're using it. Then I'll talk more about the algorithm, and then I'll finish up by talking about uncertainty analysis. So just to say, you know, sort of make a mathematically crisp statement of what we're trying to do, we're trying to find the value that is the global minimum of this function f. Now, f is going to be a simulation model. So it's something that, think of it, maybe it takes me an hour to run it. It's what we call a black box function. I'm assuming I don't know a lot about how its internal mechanisms work. That it's, because many times when you're working with these big environmental models, they're just too complicated. You know, you can't, it's not like you can sit down and say, oh, it has this nice simple structure. Model is deterministic, but possibly non-convex or multimodal, and it's costly to evaluate, so that we're concerned about not having to simulate it too many times, and its derivatives are not available. And I'm going to go into this in somewhat more detail. So why are we looking at this kind of problem? Well, costly is a shorter word for computationally expensive functions, so I'll use the word costly here. So why do I care about costly functions? Well, costly functions require a substantial amount of computation, sometimes days or weeks even. Examples include simulation codes that solve systems of nonlinear partial differential equations. For example, climate, groundwater are two examples of really computationally intensive models. But that's not certainly the only one. I mean, there's other ones as well. And our method is seeking to minimize the number of costly function evaluations, because you cannot, you know, a lot of optimization is focused around this asymptotic idea. Does it converge asymptotically? Well, if you can only do 100 evaluations because the model takes a week per evaluation, that's all you can do. And you can't talk about, well, what happens if I could do 100,000 evaluations? It's just not feasible to do that. So our focus is that you kind of define how many evaluations that you can make and what's the best way to do that, to get an answer. It may not be the absolute global minimum, but it's close to it. So our goal also is to do it in a derivative-free way. Why do we want to not use derivatives? When I was trained as a mathematician, and for many decades this carried on, I mean, to me, optimization and derivatives were just like this. That was the way to do it. It was the elegant way to do optimization, elegant and morally correct, you know, way to do it was that it was mathematically based. But it turns out when you get to these really complicated models, derivatives are sometimes unavailable. How are you going to get them? Well, one way you get them is to do finite differencing. You know, you just take a delta x and you simulate the model twice and then you compare the results and calculate the derivative. Well, that's very expensive and it's also inaccurate because it depends upon how big you make this difference when you're doing the the difference. You can use automatic differentiation, but that actually can be a lot of work to set up for a complicated function. Also, sometimes you don't have access to the source code. A lot of times these models are so complicated, they're commercial models, you cannot get into them and manipulate and find. You do something like automatic differentiation. So automatic differentiation is a great method. I'm just saying that there's many cases where that's not necessarily the appropriate thing to do. If your derivatives are inaccurate, they lead to inefficient gradient-based optimization. It's going to be very sensitive to how accurate they are. And so the method that we're developing does not require the derivatives. Also, we're interested in black box functions and also multimodal, including non-convex functions. Why black box? Well, I wondered why in my area, with the people around me in civil engineering, there was so much interest in things like genetic algorithms, and they take so much time to get answers, you know, I couldn't understand it. And I finally figured out, well, one, you don't need to know much about optimization to be able to use them because they, there's software packages that are quite robust that you can use as long as you don't mind, you know, doing a zillion evaluations. The other thing was that you could just take the model and you could hook it to the genetic algorithm and you didn't have to have an applied mathematician who spent a year studying the model to figure out what all of its features were. You could just hook them together. And that makes a big difference with some kind of code as to whether or not people are going to... They like learning one code, like they learn how to run the genetic algorithm code, and then they want to apply it to everything. So that's what we're trying to do here, is develop something that's more accurate and more efficient than a genetic algorithm for these kinds of smooth, continuous problems, but has this black box feature that it's not relying on derivative information or knowing that the function is, you know, quadratic or exponential or something. So gradient-based methods, one of the problems is that gradient-based methods, optimization methods, stop at local minima instead of searching further for the global minimum. That's one of the problems and why we'd like to get away from just straight gradient-based or derivative-based methods. For black box functions, we don't know if the function is non-convex or convex. And our method is a good global optimizer method for black box and other non-convex functions. So this is the issue with, as you probably all remember, but if these would be local minima, if you use something like a steepest descent method, you're going to stop at this point, whereas what we're really trying to find is this solution right here. This we're assuming a picture with a one-dimensional parameter value that you're optimizing over, but of course what we really care about is a many high-dimensional system, but it's just harder to draw that. Why do we care about multimodal functions? With complex nonlinear models, we typically don't know if the model's multimodal, and hence to analyze a complex model, we need to search for the global minimum, even though we do not know that it necessarily has them. So that's an important factor. I mean, I think many people regard global optimization as, you know, out in the left field of optimization, but to me, the kind of problems that we work on, we almost never know if it has a local minimum or not. And so if you don't know, you really want the best answer, then you're going to go around and you're going to have to treat it like a global problem. So global optimization capability is important when dealing with complex nonlinear models. Everything we're doing here is nonlinear. If you have linear models, then there's lots of wonderful things you can do, like linear programming, and you don't need these methods, but it's when they're messy and nonlinear. So our problem is then we want to minimize a function f. So we're going to assume f is a simulation model, expensive to compute, and it's going to be, for example, a measure, if we're talking about calibration problems, it's a measure of the error between model predictions and observations. And but in order to get the model prediction, you have to run the simulation model, so that's why it's expensive to calculate. And then d is our, x is our set of parameter values, which is from a compact set d. And we have a fixed maximum number of function evaluations that the user decides how many evaluations can I afford to make. I'm going to skip over that slide. So what we're trying to use are function approximation methods, or you can also call them response surface or surrogate models. But the main idea is that this function f, which costs maybe an hour or a week to simulate, is being approximated by a function r. And this function r is, in our case, is going to be a radial basis spline. It takes a while to fit the spline, but once you've got it fit, to go back in and get a point off that surface takes a nanosecond. So it's an insignificant computational time compared to the cost for simulating this function f. And we're using radial basis functions for our function approximation, but other methods could also be used. We've used neural nets, for example, and we find they don't work as well as radial basis functions. And why are we doing this? Well, we're doing it so that we don't have to evaluate the function so often. So we have to start off with something. We have to do this approximation of our expensive function. So we have to have some points, so we want to spread them out in space in a sensible way. So we use a symmetric Latin hypercube to pick these points. And so this is now just a picture, a one-dimensional picture, to show you what's happening. If we assume that we had just one parameter, and say our Latin hypercube then picked these three values for the point, so we did these three values and got this value of the objective function, which is our measure of error, then each of these, remember, took us a half hour to compute, for example, if we assume it's a half hour function. And then what we do is we draw our response surface through those points, and different ways of doing it, but you're trying to, and the purpose of this is to get some estimate of what's the value of the function in these ranges where I don't actually have real values. Now the question is, what's the next point that I pick? Where along this, remember each evaluation is another half hour simulation, where along here am I going to pick a point? Well, let's assume that I go over here and pick a point, and this is the value that I get. Well, now I rebuild my function approximation so that it looks like this, and actually this point gave me a huge amount of information. It says, you know, you should be searching over in this region. The reason I didn't want to go to the minimum of the surface here before was that I would have gone right back to a point that I'd already been at. I wouldn't want to spend another half hour simulating something that's just very, very close to what I already calculated. So that's the idea, partly, of this, is you're doing these response surfaces, you're recalculating them in every period. So what I want to show you first, I thought I'd show you the example first, and then we'll go a little bit more into the a really big example, and then go into the algorithm. So this was started, actually the person who built this original model is now here in Toronto. I think he works in the stock exchange or something, but he was an environmental engineer at one point. And the idea is that you have, there's, it's a serious problem with chlorinated ethenes. We have an expert in chlorinated ethenes here in the room, and Dr. Sleep has, you want to inject what are called hydrogen donors into the ground so that they will promote biological activity that will degrade the contaminant that is here. And so the degradation is happens by providing hydrogen into the ground. And this is a very serious problem. Decontamination of groundwater can cost hundreds of millions of dollars. So a single optimization at a single site would be an important thing. This is just a picture of the model that's under use. I just want you to, I'm not going to go into details of this model, but except to say that it's very complicated. It has 22 species. It's a partial differential equation model, so you have all these nodes. At each node, we have 22 species. And what's really bad is equations between them use monode growth kinetics, so you have variables both in the numerator and the denominator, variables that you're differentiating, so it makes the, you know, it makes it really messy to take trying to take derivatives from something like that. So the objective function is the sum of squared errors, or related function is based on the difference between the data and the corresponding model prediction. But you, that means you have to do a simulation every time you make, you evaluate the objective function. It's, the equations are highly nonlinear. We're going to look at two different cases. One is hypothetical. It's an 8 minute per simulation. And one is 3 hours per simulation. This is the real field case, the real field data, from Alameda, California, one of the DOD sites. We looked here at several different algorithms that were being used at this time in the water resources community. We looked at genetic algorithms, which are very popular. We looked at this method, which is an evolutionary method we thought was better than genetic algorithms. We looked at a derivative-based method in MATLAB, FMNCon, which is a sequential quadratic programming procedure. We used a very simple greedy algorithm, and then this is our method, which is based on a radial basis function approach, and then this is an earlier method with radial basis functions that we also compared. These are stochastic methods, so we had to do everything 10 times, so when you, or could have been 30 times, and you're trying to compare these different methods, you don't, shouldn't just look at one run of each method, because it may have to do with, you know, you're not always get the same result. And what we're trying to do is to make recommendations to people, what's a robust method if you're going to only do it once, because that's what you would do in a real case. So this is on a smaller test case, which is still, it's a realistic aquifer and everything. So along this axis is the objective function, which we want to be low, and along this axis is the number of function evaluations that you've made. So this is primarily, this is how much computation you've done. Because all the other calculations, like building the response surfaces, are, it's so small that it doesn't really count. This is what counts, is the number of function evaluations. So you, the lowest curve is the best curve. Here's all the different methods. This red one is our method right here. This up here are the genetic algorithms. And notice this is a logarithmic scale. So when we're at 60 evaluations, we're down to 10 to the minus 1, and the genetic algorithm is at 10 to the 1. So it's a 100-fold difference in terms of the value of the objective function. This is a Nash Sutcliffe in this case. And one of the things, I said also we've done 10 trials. So this is showing the variability of the results. So the middle point is the mean, which you saw on the previous graph. This is after 100 evaluations. And So this one actually did equally well with only 60 evaluations, but here we're allowing all the others to have 100 evaluations. And you can see not only does this have the lowest mean, but it also has very little variability. But almost all the runs were successful, which is important. Now we go to the real site. This running time, well, it was 2.5 hours. It keeps, the running time keeps diminishing as we get new computers, but it still was a long running time. And in finite element model, it's set up like this. It's in three dimensions. And if you look at all the species and the time points and the nodes, it ends up being 153 million unknowns. So that's why it takes a long time to run these. And it's not big for groundwater problems. Some of them are worse than that. So in this case, because it took so long, we couldn't do as many evaluations. We just did three. We took the best three, the best four of the algorithms, and we did three runs on each one of them. And this is the results that we got. And this is now blow up this area here. So ours still did better. It's not as dramatically different as it was on the smaller problem. But it shows that it doesn't prove that this method is going to work best on every single problem, but it does show that there is a difference, and that it's and all these are much better than genetic algorithms, which is partly what we were trying to show. And also better than a derivative-based method, FMinCon. And again, if you look at the variability, so that the FMinCon, although it did pretty well in terms of averages, it was really its variability, meaning there were a lot of bad answers because it gets stuck in the local minimum. So conclusions on this example are that our function approximation algorithm generally outperformed the algorithms, other algorithms considered, but this was based on a limited number of function evaluations. If you said you had 10,000 evaluations to run, then probably some other method would be better. This is really designed as a case where we're only doing like 100 evaluations for really quite a difficult problem. Now, maybe we didn't get the absolute minimum, global minimum. We probably didn't, and we don't always know. But you could see that there was a big drop from what we started with, so we must have gotten a pretty good answer. And so that's why it's a... It's a really important thing, because you cannot do 10,000 evaluations on many of these methods. So how are you gonna deal with those problems if you can't figure out a way to get a reasonably good answer in a limited number of evaluations? So now I'm going to talk a little bit more about the algorithm, and this is actually a later paper, so it's, you know, things are a little bit more refined. This is the Informed Journal of Computing, and remember, this is the case we were talking about when we take the three points and we do the approximation like this, and remembering that, of course, in real case, we want to deal with X is multidimensional. X was 6 or 8 in the previous problems I showed you, 6 or 8 dimensional in those two problems. Now, how do we do that surface? How do we make that surface that I just showed in the previous slide? Well, we use radio basis functions, and that has this form right here, and then this is a linear polynomial right here. So this is the form of our approximation, and the particular function here that you use on the radio basis function, in other words, what's it shaped like? It's going to be all the same going out from a point, but what's the shape? Is it like this, or is it like this, or... And that has to do with these different forms here. But if we take one of them, say the this is a multi-quartic, so what you have are the three, each, like here's a data point, and then you have this blue dashed line is the basis function around that point, and then we had another point over here, and this red one is the line around that point. You see it has almost no slope on it. And then this green one is the expansion around this point over here. So each of these basis functions has as its center one of the points at which you evaluated the function, one of your previous data points. And then the particular values, the curves here, are something that it is fit to get to the data, because the interpolation method, you see, it actually goes through the points. So you solve a linear system in order to get the proper weights. So the outline of our method is to use some kind of a space-filling procedure. You make an approximation of the function. Then you use our algorithm to select the next evaluation point. You construct a new function approximation. And then you stop if you reach the maximum number of iterations, which you set from the beginning. And if you haven't reached that, then you go back up here. So the real crux here is, how do you pick the next function evaluation point? Because it's so expensive that to do these evaluations, you want to pick them in a very good way. So we've developed multiple ways of doing that, and I'll talk about two of them and compare to some other things. So we want the new point for evaluation to be as far away from previously evaluated points. As I said, if you've already spent half an hour simulating the model for this value of the parameter, you don't want to come back and simulate it for this value of the parameter if there's a whole bunch of the rest of the space that you don't really know about what's happening. But you also want to assume that the function approximation value is low. I mean, if we're trying to minimize, that's why we have this function approximation curve. It's to try to help us figure out what is the true value of the function. We used to use linear programming to solve this problem, but we found that actually generating points randomly is a better numerical solution. So we have, with our metric stochastic response surface method, to generate the next evaluation point, we first generate a set of random candidates in our space. This is our susceptible space of parameters. Each candidate point is given a score between 0 and 1 on each of two criteria. One is the response surface criterion, you know, how low is this curve at that point, and how far away is it from previously evaluated points. Since we already know those values, we don't learn as much if we end up sampling more points right close to them. So, for example, this might, if we had this curve right here, we might have, maybe our candidate points would be these three points right here, and then when we looked, weighed the difference between being away from all the other points versus what the value of the response surface was, we ended up going with this one, which was the one that gave us that very useful point. So that's the idea, is you're generating multiple candidate points, and then you guess based on how far away they are from other points and what the response surface curve is as to which of the candidate points you would pick. Now, I've only drawn three here, but it's cost us nothing to do this, so we can generate 50 or 100 of these and evaluate those, and from those pick the ones that seem best. However, the two criteria are often in conflict, and hence we have to pursue a trade-off by considering a weighted score of the distance from each other and the value of the response surface. I think I'm going to skip over this. We got started a little bit late. But we have two versions of this procedure. Both of them are simple and easy to implement. They require less computational effort to generate the next evaluation point compared to alternative response surface methods. Easily includes nonlinear constraint problems and can be used with any response surface or function approximation method, like neural nets, for example. We do have a convergence theorem for a metric stochastic response surface method. This convergence method also holds for other types of selection criteria and other types of probability distributions. This is because stochastic response surface method is a form of random search, which is hopefully accelerated by the use of function approximation. So what it says is that if you use this method, it will converge almost surely to the true solution. But that's helpful in that it says it doesn't stop at a local minimum. But the reality is that we are really focused on trying to get these solutions with relatively few evaluations. So, you know, this theorem isn't that central to what we're doing, because this is really an asymptotic theorem. But still, it's nice to, if you can say something about how something behaves asymptotically, that's useful. Since there are no theoretical results for rates of convergence, you know, with local methods, sometimes you can say, oh, they converge quadratically, or they converge linearly or superlinearly. That's very useful information. But since there's no theoretical results for rates of convergence, comparison to alternative algorithms has to be done empirically. And you know, the caveat would be, I'm going to show you some results, but the results might have been different if we had done different problems. And so that's one of the reasons why we tried to do a number of different problems here to see what kind of results we would get. So what is maybe interesting is when you compare then the results, how do you compare these different algorithms? One thing is we're dealing with global, we know the problem is global, so we want to have a global optimization method. However, what many people in the optimization literature will say, who are local optimizers experts, will say, well, the way to solve a global problem is just to restart it a really good local optimizer at many different starting points, and eventually it's going to find the global optimum. Well, that's possible, and there's even some systematic procedures for doing it, a multi-starting this with a procedure called multi-level single linkage that actually, again, you can show that eventually you will converge, you know, with probability one or converge almost surely if you do enough evaluations using this systematic multi-start procedure. So that's one of the options that we considered. And then the second one was to use something that was actually intended to be a global optimization model and didn't necessarily need to be multi-started. So we're going to compare then the three optimization global methods and also a number of multi-methods using three local optimizers. And these are the local methods that we considered were SQP, which is FMNCon in MATLAB, Pattern Search, which is in the MATLAB toolbox, and Ubiqua, as implemented in this MATLAB code by these guys, Bergen and Versini. And the global methods that we used were two of ours. This was our original global optimization method, and then this is a somewhat more local kind of, it goes after the, you know, the really low points more aggressively, and then simulated annealing, and also this is another radial basis function method. And the simulated annealing, we tried to make it as good as we could. I don't know if you know that much about simulated annealing, but there's parameters you have to choose within that. We tried to pick them to work well with this system, including the fact we had a limited number of evaluations. So we solved 17 problems and one small real problem. All methods were repeated in 30 trials, and what are shown are the values of the means over these 30 trials. So now we're doing, on these test cases, they were small, we could do them fast, so we did actually 30 trials instead of 10. And in those methods, our method, the local metric stochastic RBF, was the best among the eight algorithms considered when you got to higher dimensions, like six dimensions up to 14 or so, and did comparable to the other ones on lower dimensions. And our original method, which is a much more global kind of method, was okay, but wasn't nearly as good as our local method. So these are examples of the kind of things that we get. This happens to Shekel. Problem is a very difficult problem. You wouldn't expect so much that a response surface method would work very well because it has these like little crevices and you can get caught in, but it actually, this is our algorithm, and so it did really well. So again, lowest curve is best. This is the objective function value. You're trying to get it low, and this is the number of function evaluations, which is directly related to the total amount of computational effort that you put in. I mean, one way to look at this is to say, for example, that this method with 52 evaluations was doing as well on average as, you know, some of these other ones out at 200. So it's you can look at it both going horizontally or vertically. It's also, obviously, when they all did 200, it was doing the best. This one has a dimension of 11. This also did very well. 14. 14, this again did very well. I mean, the paper has 17 functions in it, so it's not all of them are this good, but they on average they're this method is much better than the others. This is on the groundwater problem, actually this is a PDE problem, actually a bioremediation one, although a simpler one than the one I talked about before, and you can see it has It does do better, but it's not that much. Actually, this other one is ours, also ours, is greedy RBF, which is just sort of a simpler version of this. If you look at, for example, Powell's method, obliqua, which is, I guess it's this one up here. The reason it stays up so high is that this method requires, it's a quadratic approximation, so you always need to do the dimension, something on the order of the dimension squared number of points to even start the procedure. So once the dimension gets up to 12, that method is still out here. It's still building its initial quadratic approximation before it can get started. So that's one of the advantages to using this method as opposed to using a full quadratic, is you don't have to use so many points to get your initial approximation. So conclusions on this then is the local RBF outperformed the other algorithms when looking at the suite of global test problems with limited numbers of simulations. Again, that's very important. We weren't doing 10,000 evaluations. The different method might have been better. So what are we doing? There's still a lot to do in this area. We're developing parallel algorithms. We have some parallel algorithms that are synchronous, and eventually we'll probably look at asynchronous parallel algorithms, meaning you're not waiting to get the next step started for all the different processors to be at the same place. We've done a comparison with radial basis functions with neural nets, and the radial basis functions seem to be more effective for this in the context of this algorithms. We've developed a local optimization method using trust regions and radial basis functions. We just submitted that paper. We are developing, but have not yet written a paper on improving a multi-start method for our own global methods, and we're going to be working on applications to other real problems. Now, the last section I want to talk about is, so that's going to end the optimization section, and to say that we think that's a really important problem, this idea of how do you solve these really big computationally expensive models? How do you get optimal solutions or close to optimal solutions with relatively few evaluations? Now, the next problem is, if you remember when I had the original slide at the beginning, once you got the model, then what do you do with it? Well, like in the case of the groundwater model that you saw, what I might want to look at is, okay, I've got all the models calibrated. Now, I want to predict how long is it going to be until the groundwater is cleaned up? You know, until that, meaning that no chlorinated ethenes are leaving the boundary of my site. How long is that going to take? That would be an example of a model prediction. Well, maybe the model says that, you know, using the deterministic values of the parameters, the average, the ones that we got from the optimization, says, well, that's going to take 6 years. But what we know, there's uncertainty associated with this. You know, we know there's errors in the model and the data and is there some quantifiable way? Is the uncertainty that it's 6 years plus or minus a month, or is it 6 years plus or minus 6 years? You know, there are methods to do uncertainty analysis. They tend to be very, very expensive. They do things like Monte Carlo procedures or something akin to those, which they're doing tens of thousands of simulations. And our question was, how do we solve this problem, or at least get a reasonable estimate with 100 or 200 or just a few simulations? How do we go about doing that? So this is a project that I have with David Rupert, who's a statistician, and we have a paper on that that's been sort of, they wanted us to make some changes, and we sent it back in again. So we're interested in relationship between data used to calibrate the model. Remember, environmental models or climate models or any of these other fields, there's a relationship between the data that's used to calibrate the model and the uncertainty. The goal of our project is to assess the uncertainty in the calibrated models and the model outputs. And the procedure combines our optimization methods that has function approximation procedures with Bayesian analysis. So how did environmental engineers typically calculate uncertainty? Well, they use this method called GLUE, which I guess I'm not going to go into the details of it. It is not, but except to say that is computationally intensive and it is not statistically rigorous. And when I talk to people in my field, I have to argue with them to say, you know, really that's not the right way to do it. You should do it some of the other ways. But some of the other ways are also that existed in the past, which is like Bayesian analysis using Markov chain Monte Carlo, takes at least 10,000 simulations. So although it's statistically rigorous, it's also very computationally intensive. So we're trying to come up with an alternative to that that will enable us to do this kind of analysis on some of these big models, which is currently not feasible. So in this case now, our objective function is the likelihood function. So the likelihood function includes the basic parameters as well as transformations to convert non-normal random variables into normal random variables. We want to approximate the objective function, being the likelihood function, in parameter space. So that's what we're doing different from what other people have done, is to approximate this in parameter space. We want to use the optimization search to find the global maximum and important local maxima. So finding the maximum likelihood estimator is like now we have a function we're trying to find its maximum instead of the minimum where we're trying to minimize error in the previous graph. But it's the same idea. So we're still using the initial steps are the same as what we talked about before, trying to solve this calibration problem. But now we do additional evaluations around local minima to get more accurate description of the function. And then we build a function approximation of the objective function based on all this information. So here's my hand-drawn picture of what this looks like, but imagine that our likelihood function, say if we had just one parameter, and of course we really have many parameters, say it looked like this, and we don't care too much about what's happening down here because this is a low probability region, so it's not going to really affect our output very much. But we do care a lot about getting the shape right up here in these higher probability regions. So imagine it doesn't need to be unimodal. It could have multiple modes, and maybe you, in the optimization search, you discover those multiple modes. Well, then what we do is we try to find what you're not only trying to find the global maximum, but also find some of the local maxima. And then we do additional evaluations around those points to get this approximation better. So it's a challenge to get a good approximation of the likelihood function. But what we're doing is the simulations that we did, we're reusing them. The simulations that we did to find this point, for example, this point here, now we're reusing it because we had values. We had values for all those points, and we can then now fit a surface to them. So the optimization problem is then changed. We're trying to find all the important local maxima. So based on the costly function evaluations done in the optimization search and additional function evaluations, we build an approximation of the likelihood, doing maybe hundreds of simulations, not tens of thousands. Then we apply this method, statistically rigorous method called Markov chain Monte Carlo, which normally what it's done without the kind of method we're using, they just sample the real function. They do 10,000 simulations of the real function. They keep sampling it in a systematic way to get an estimate of the distribution. But we're going to use it instead. We sample our function approximation of the likelihood function. So we're replacing the true simulation with this approximation. And we do that, say, 10,000 or more times. But this costs us nothing because we're doing it on the function evaluation. The only part that costs us money or costs us time is the hundreds of simulations that we did in order to build the original surface. So there's four steps. We locate the regions of high posterior density with the optimization search. We find an experimental design that covers the region of the high posterior density. Likelihood is evaluated on this design. We use the function evaluations from the steps above to approximate the posterior. This is Bayesian, so it's the posterior. And then we do Markov chain Monte Carlo and standard Bayesian analysis using the approximate posterior density, in other words, the one from our function approximation. Now, okay, so that's, one of the points is here is we want to do, in our optimization procedure, we don't want to use a derivative-based optimization method because you end up getting points that are too close together and then you can't use them to build the surface. You get ill-conditioned matrices if you try to build a surface with points that are too close together. So that was something that we learned in the process, that there was other reasons for using a non-derivative, a derivative-free method. So here's the example that we used. This is a chemical spill problem. The idea is these two red arrows show where there was a chemical that spills into a channel. Yes, it's a channel. And these balls are where we have data that was measured. And we're trying to, based on the data that we have measured, we're trying to estimate the mass of material that went in here and the time and the location of the second spill and also the diffusion coefficient in the river here. So that would be an example of a, you know, trying to estimate some of the parameters in the model. And this, we're trying to, we want to be able to compare it to the case where we really do the 10,000 evaluations. So what we used here, this particular problem happens to have this analytical solution. But we're, and that's why we're using it, so we can compare it against the real one. But of course, our real goal is to use this on things for which you, you don't have an analytical solution. So the following slides show the results. The objective function is more is primarily has a one local maximum. The solid line that you're going to look at is the true value of the PDF. The true value meaning we actually did the 10,000 simulations of the Markov chain Monte Carlo. And the colored line, the colored dashed line, shows the PDF obtained by the MCMC on the function approximation. So in other words, we're saying we can make this approximation and we hope it will work out, but until you look at it, you don't know, was this a successful idea or did it fail? So these are for four different parameters. And so as I said, the solid line is the true value. And the dashed line is the one using only 100, so we used 150 real expensive function evaluations, built the approximation, and then sampled from that approximate surface. That's what you're seeing here. There's a couple different forms of the likelihood function. That's why there's a couple different colors, but they're pretty much the same. But what you can see is, now this is like a PDF, right? Statistically, once you know the probability density function of something, you know everything about it statistically. And so that's what this is now telling you. For each of these parameters, you can, from this, you can get its mean, its variance, what's the probability that it's above or below a certain level. So this is a really good difference. So notice this is a 60-fold difference in computational effort. So 60-fold reduction in computational demands. Now, we also want to look at the output. A lot of times that's what you want to know, really want to know. It's not just what are the parameter values, it's what I'm making a prediction about, you know, is it going to be 6 years or 12 years or what in terms of how long it's going to take for this contamination to go away. So what we really want to know is the uncertainty in the model output. So this is going to show a comparison of the prediction of the average concentrations, again, using our function approximation method versus a conventional method. So the output that we want is this one. Here's our channel. And then we're looking further down the channel. We want to know what's the average concentration down at this point. And again, here's a comparison of the posterior output and versus the solid line, which is the true value, and very good fit. So I'm very excited about this. A huge difference in the amount of calculations that we did. And this is not just important. I mean, if you have a small model, it saves you a little bit of computer time. That's nice. So what's really significant about this is this means you could begin to do these kinds of analysis on models that are much bigger than what is at all feasible to do normally. So these results indicated we were able to get good results with much less computational effort, doing 150 versus 10,000. So what have we achieved? Applied modern statistical tools, because this method is statistically rigorous. At least I'm told that by the distinguished colleague that my statistical colleague that we worked with. We've implemented a Bayesian method of uncertainty analysis and substantially reduced the number of evaluations that were required. So I think this really opens it up to doing this kind of analysis on much more complicated problems. So thank you very much.